It's 9:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn all this week on the Ideas Network. This being 9 o'clock on Monday, it's all things political as we talk about the political news of the last few days and the last week and try to figure out what, if anything, it all means. I'll have plenty of help because I know that our listeners will be calling in with their suggestions about political stories and what they think. And we have a couple of guests joining us by phone to also assist in this process. Let me start by giving you the phone numbers so that you know how to connect with us. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, however, we'd appreciate it if you'd use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. Joining me by phone to discuss the political news of the day, we have Lana Atkison, professor of political science at the University of New Mexico. Good morning, Professor Atkison. And we have Margie Hershey, professor of political science at Indiana University. Well, good morning to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, a lot of stuff to talk about. Let's just start off with perhaps the biggest political story of the last week, and that being the gloves really starting to come off in the race for the Democratic nomination for president. Late last week, Hillary Clinton was accused of playing the gender card. There was the dust up earlier regarding remarks on about driver's licenses for illegal aliens in New York. Lots to talk about there. What about this latest flap concerning Hillary Clinton and the supposedly playing the gender card? And I'll just leave it as a toss up for either one who wants to go first here.
Well, I think there's two different cards there. There's the gender card, and then there's the victim card. And the victim card is when she complained about that they were all ganging up on her, and I think she has to be careful with that one. That's probably not a card she can play. She's the front runner. She needs to expect hard-hitting messages from others, questions, things like that. But with regard to the gender card, she is a woman. She's the only woman in the race, and it seems like that's a fair card to play.
There was, of course, let's just talk about the fact that there seems to be a step up in terms of the intensity of the rhetoric being used by her opponents. I guess we should have expected this. Is it earlier than we thought? Have her opponents waited longer than maybe that we thought they might? What can we interpret from this?
Well, I think it's perfectly understandable that the campaign is starting to become much more intense now because Clinton is emerging much more as the front runner now. But I think the one question we really need to ask is it going to make any difference in terms of these people's performance as possible presidents, whether or not they attack one another or criticize one another or say that one another is female or one another is black? I mean, Does this really matter to our perceptions of the campaign?
And then there was a story that just the first time I heard it was on NPR News this morning, another kind of mini dust-up. Now there's some controversy over the release of certain papers from the Clinton presidency, and there have been accusations that the Clintons have tried to suppress correspondence between the president and Hillary Clinton, President Clinton saying this is basically not true. Is this more gotcha politics, or is there something to this, do you think?
Well, I don't know. If you were running for president, John, and if your wife had written you a letter and you didn't think it was all that useful to your presidential campaign, do you think it would say something about your character if you were to try to suppress it?
Probably.
I suspect I'd do the same. I think the challenge is that what we've got here is a year and a half long presidential race to deal with, and none of us are entirely pleased with doing that, and the result is that we end up spending an awful lot of time talking about things that may or may not matter in terms of whether or not somebody is going to make a good president of the United States. And I guess then the question becomes, is there any way to try to shorten this campaign? And I suppose the answer is no. Given that we have a fixed election time, you know, we know right now when the presidential election is going to be in the year 2024, there isn't anything that stops candidates from starting to run right now for that particular time. And as a result, we end up with presidential campaigns that are just insanely long. If this were in France or in Britain, the presidential campaign would be about 3 or 4 weeks long.
That would suit me.
We'd have a chance to discuss things that are really significant, and then they'd vote and we'd be done. But unfortunately, we don't have that luxury around here.
Well, I'm waiting for the story to appear in the papers about who the front runner is for 2012. I'm expecting that any day now.
Should happen right after January 3rd or 4th, I think.
Oh, yes. You think it'll wait that long? Let's start an office pool.
It really is a very difficult thing for American voters, though, because if we're going to do any kind of reasonable decision-making, we're going to have to be able to cut through all of this and be able to figure out how to focus on the things that are most important and somehow deal with the fact that we've had 18 months' worth of presidential campaign. That's just really an enormous imposition on American voters, and the difficulty is that really there's no way to stop it.
It requires a lot of money, too.
Oh, and the more money it requires, of course, the more people who have that money are able to make a difference in the outcome. I'm sorry, Lonnie, you were going to say something.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think that some of the things that Senator Clinton is getting hit with currently are, you know, really important and sort of precursors to what she's likely to get hit with Republicans if she does become the nominee. So if a primary is a testing ground for candidates, then these sorts of character issues do become important. They're emotional issues that voters can respond to, rightly or wrongly. I mean, they're going to respond to those. And so I think that there is some good reason for her to be tested in this way now, because it's going to get a lot harder if she becomes the nominee.
I think the thing, I certainly appreciate your point. I think the thing that concerns me the most is that it tends to encourage people to judge nominees on a basis that's not very rational. If we were to take a look at the most common criticism of Hillary Clinton, which, at least in my view from what I've read, is that she seems to be a cold personality. I often wanted to ask people who are concerned about that why it matters to them. I mean, if I were going to invite her over for dinner on Friday, I would definitely be concerned about whether or not she's a warm or a cold person. But, you know, if I did, I doubt very much that she'd come. And so the result is, what difference should it make if she's going to be president to whether she is warm or cold? I mean, members of Congress are big boys and big girls. I think they know they have to work with a president no matter whether they like him or her or not.
Well, I think it's an authenticity issue for voters, and I think that, you know, what, you know, rightly or wrongly, from a normative perspective, those issues are things that voters really are responsive to. And I think the underlying thing that she's going to get hit with by the Republicans is more about this flip-flopping thing, that she's not clear about her opinions, that she's trying to hide a liberal agenda, that, you know, I think that those are the things that are going to be hard-hitting over the course of election. And she's a very polarizing figure, and she's talented in that she's pretty good at on the stump and being responsive. So she's, I think, very talented as a campaigner, but she is going to have to face these kinds of arguments that John Kerry had to face about being wishy-washy. Now, her husband seemed to handle it very well, and the question is, can she handle it very well? Because it's important for, you know, voters to get a sense of people's authenticity, and I think voters worry in some sense when they don't know where somebody stands and they aren't sure about them, and they sort of have this image of them, you know, moving back and forth across issues so easily. I think that isn't right in their gut. And even though sort of I certainly agree with Marjorie that I think there should be this intellectual side of things, that voters still tend to respond to this sort of gut level approach to campaign politics. And, you know, that gut, as Stephen Colbert would say, is a really important moving force in politics.
Well, let's switch over to the Republican side for a moment. Rudy Giuliani, there was a story in the New York Times over the weekend, I think it was. Rudy Giuliani is seen as sporting the strongest coattails and could be of huge help to the Republican congressional effort, particularly in the Northeast, where they risk losing some seats, where they lost, the Republicans lost seats in the last congressional election. Here's another advantage for Giuliani, at least among the people who kind of look at numbers and try and figure out which presidential candidate would do them the most good in Congress. How likely is this to help Giuliani with the people who oppose him within his own party for other reasons?
I think that's a puzzle, actually, because when I first read that article and saw that people were concerned about saving Republican seats in the Northeast, I thought, what Republican seats in the Northeast? I mean, both of them, you know, are going to be up for grabs in any case. The Republican Party used to have its greatest strength 50 years ago in the Northeast, and second to that in the Midwest. It had very, very little strength, almost none in the South. Now its strength in the Northeast is just trivial. And so I'm not really convinced, first of all, that there's that much in the Northeast for the Republicans to save. And secondly, the thing that I find most puzzling about this is that we know from polls that of the Republicans who are pro-life and who are favoring Giuliani right now, and there are substantial numbers of those, about half of them are not aware that Giuliani is not pro-life. About half of them don't know that he's pro-choice. The question becomes, how big a deal is that to them? And, you know, although some of us might think, wow, they've really been incredibly successful at avoiding that information so far, sooner or later, it's going to pop up. And when that does, what's going to happen to their feelings about Giuliani?
Yes, and the gay rights issue, I think, is also one where they're unaware of his leanings. And at some point, I agree with Marjorie, that's got to come up.
There are photos out there of Giuliani in drag, I mean, at various city events in New York. And
Boy, thanks a lot for that.
You know, this is not going to play real well in the Baptist temples in rural Alabama.
Well, there were rumblings last month from James Dobson and others who are allied with him about starting another, putting up their own candidate and running a third party if the Republican nominee wasn't someone to their liking. How serious do you think that is?
I think they're too smart for that. We've known for a long time that third parties are hugely disadvantaged in American elections. Ross Perot was the single exception to that, and even so, that took, 86 million dollars in order to break the kinds of difficulties that third parties normally have. I think perhaps what they're saying is that if they could just demonstrate a big vote for an evangelical candidate, that maybe that would, you know, cause the Republican Party to say, well, we lost X million votes because we nominated Giuliani. But I think when they put that on one side of the scale and then put Hillary Clinton as president on the other side of the scale, I think they're going to find that the scale sort of dips along the side of, we can't take 4 years of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I do think that there is the Unity 08 party is out there. Now, they're not a religious right party, but they are a party working on trying to have a virtual election in July to nominate their candidate. They want to have a Democrat and a Republican. They have lots of volunteers. Certainly, if you look at the numbers in terms of, you know, right track, wrong track in the country, things like that, Unity 08, it suggests that a third party might have an opportunity to rear its head. Of course, the chance of that party winning is extremely low, as Marjorie pointed out. But I do think there's a possibility of some kind of third party coming in this election.
We're at break time. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we have people waiting to join us by phone who want to get in on the discussion. Before the end of the hour, though, I want to make sure that we touch on some remarks that Fred Thompson made on Meet the Press yesterday. I found them very interesting, and I think they're worthy of some discussion. But I'll give the phone numbers again before we go to break, and then when we come back, we'll actually take some calls from our listeners. 800-486-8655. 227-2050. That's how to get in touch with us here at the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:23. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. I have to try and remember who it is I'm substituting for. That would be an important thing to know. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. She's one of the most powerful activist voices in the 20th century. After three on Here on Earth, Jean Faraca talks with Frances Moore LaPay about her visionary new blueprint for how to revitalize our democracy. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political, and I have two guests with me by phone trying to sort out what all of the political news that we can cram into 1 hour of radio actually means. Margie Hershey, Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, and Lana R. Atkinson, Professor of Political Science at the University of New Mexico. And I'm going to keep my promise by going to the phones, and we'll take a call first from Robert in Superior.
Good morning,
Robert.
These letters between Hillary and Bill, if Hillary was the standard First Lady who did coffee teas and charity events, then those letters are none of our business. But when you're trying to affect national policy and you're running health care commissions, those aren't just letters between Hillary and Bill as a husband and wife. They're letters about her attempts to affect national policy. So they're open to the public when she entered the public light as the unelected politician.
Okay, Robert, thanks for that call. Well, we touched on this earlier. The story came up. It's been suggested that these letters are trying to be suppressed. The Clintons are saying absolutely not. They're going to be made available, and this is a tempest in a teapot.
Yeah, it seems like they should, open up the letters and let people see what's going on in them. I mean, in terms of public interest and openness and those kinds of things, I think they're going to have to.
What about the caller's point about the difference between the way Hillary Clinton behaved as a first lady or the things that she was involved in and what we have stereotyped the first lady of the United States to be? How big a difference does that really make?
Marjorie,
Lana, why don't you take a shot at this one?
I think that, in terms of the differences, I mean, that's one of the things that she's drawing on is her experience, that she was in the White House, that she was an effective wife in terms of policy, and that she's going to draw upon those experiences and being on both sides in the White House and in the Senate has given her the kind of experience to be president. So she's drawing upon that heavily, which, again, makes those papers seem even more important.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to get the guests' comments on how this administration wants to keep us in the very fearful. These new memos that Rumsfeld had wrote that have been leaked out to keep the elevating the threat of terrorism and talk about Somalia, the Philippines, etc. Make the American people realize they are surrounded in the world by violent extremists. And, I can only think back how President Bush talks about, if we don't win, it's your children and your grandchildren are in danger, and it all comes full circle when these things come out. And I wanted to get the guest thoughts on that.
Well, I think that that's a very valid point. I think the administration has publicized a whole series of things that card designed essentially to say, don't pay attention to the fact that a lot of children don't have health insurance. Look over here at all of those enemies that are around the world, which I presume have been around the world enemies of ours for really quite some time. I think that that plays into the current race in a very interesting way, which is that it appears that former Mayor Giuliani's main appeal to Republican primary voters has to do with his stand or his activities or whatever you might want to call them after the September 11th attacks. And I don't think that Giuliani is doing quite the same degree of fear-mongering that the current administration has, but I think he's basically sort of moving in the same direction.
There was a story in the Associated Press a couple of days ago. The headline was, Bush to Dems, denial of war dangerous. President Bush compared Congress's Democratic leaders on Thursday to people who ignored the rise of Lenin and Hitler early in the last century, saying, quote, the world paid a terrible price, unquote, and risk similar consequences for inaction today. I suppose that kind of goes along with what our caller was talking about, playing up on fears of terrorism and perhaps even worse things to come.
I think that's really quite remarkable, and I think that it's worth remembering that that's the case. Certainly a lot of people have been compared to Hitler over time, and some of those comparisons have been pretty bizarre. This one is absolutely amazing, and I think that if we think about the need to hold leaders to account for what it is that they're saying and doing, this is a very good case. Of course, it's the case that the person who made that statement is not up for re-election in 2008, but it certainly would be worth thinking about it in the meantime in terms of members of Congress who chime in on that statement or who object to it.
Lana, you want to make a comment on that?
No, I think that's good.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Steve in La Crosse. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, John. I would like to talk about Giuliani for a second. I am going to be a Republican primary voter, and I think there is awareness amongst the GOP base that Giuliani has some non-traditional stances about gay marriage and abortion. But what he's promised is that he would appoint judges like Scalia and Thomas to the court, and for a lot of social conservatives, that would be good enough, despite his past record. Number two, I think the seminal issue for GOP voters and maybe the general electorate is national security and the war on terrorism. That's the one that's probably going to be in the forefront, and who can clean up Iraq. And Giuliani is, pretty good on that issue in terms of his image. And that's why GOP voters are kind of looking at him. And he's a tough campaigner, and we're looking for someone who can beat Hillary Clinton, and so that's why I think he's ahead. Personally, I think it'll be McCain, Thompson, or Giuliani because of their strengths on national security, which might be a vulnerability for Ms. Clinton.
Thanks for that call, Steve. Appreciate your comments. There's a Wisconsin voter who's supporting Rudy Giuliani and saying, "Well, we're willing to overlook some of these things because on the whole, if Giuliani could be our guy and would have the best chance of beating the presumptive Democratic nominee." And at this point, and I don't know if she's really the presumptive nominee or not. We'll have to wait and see how the primaries actually play out. But today, the way the horse race is being handicapped, she's the front runner. And that seems to have energized some people in the Republican Party, which is something that I think that was fairly predictable.
John, if I might just jump in, I was looking a couple of days ago at the primary handicapping from 2003 in November, actually the end of November 2003. You know who was the Democratic frontrunner at that time? President Howard Dean, remember President Dean? Actually, in fairness, about 25% of the folks who were asked that question at that time said that they had no clue and that Dean was only slightly ahead of several other Democratic candidates. But we may want to not sort of jump too fast with regard to President Hillary Clinton's getting the Democratic nomination.
Well, Dean, of course, had a stumble in Iowa, and that and the subsequent coverage of the so-called Dean scream more or less torpedoed his campaign. If candidates learned since then?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Hillary Clinton making the kinds of mistakes that Dean's made. I mean, she's a lot stronger campaigner. She has a lot more experience. She has certainly the money. He had a lot of money. She has name recognition, you know, across the nation. It's hard for me to imagine her. I agree a lot could happen in the race, and we could see Obama move up. But it's hard to imagine her being quite the candidate that Dean was.
Let's talk a little bit about Fred Thompson. He was on Meet the Press yesterday morning, and I happened to see that program. I was very interested in his comments about the abortion issue. And I don't know how well known his positions are on it, but it seemed to me, to summarize his position, is he thinks Roe versus Wade was a bad Supreme Court decision and would like to see us go back to the situation pre-Roe v. Wade, where the states would be in complete control of what abortion laws were on the books and what were not. And I'm wondering how that's going to affect his candidacy, if at all.
I would be very surprised at this point if Fred Thompson became a major candidate on the Republican side. I think that for a long time, while he was sitting back and deciding whether or not to make the race, there were a lot of parts of the Republican Party who turned to Thompson because there wasn't anybody else in the Republican race they felt comfortable with. And he was the great hope that perhaps when he'd step in, he would be the great communicator, the Ronald Reagan of the race. And it doesn't seem as though that's turned out to be the case. He still is fairly high in the polls, but my sense is that that has much more to do with name recognition than anything else. I think a great deal at this point in the presidential selection process has to do with name recognition, because as much as we and the people who are listening are very engaged in these questions and find them really interesting, an awful lot of the American public, perfectly understandably, is watching Dancing with the Stars and looking forward to the basketball season and just really hasn't paid an awful lot of attention. So when they hear a pollster saying, would you vote for Romney, Giuliani, McCain, or Thompson, you know, they've been watching Law and Order for a long time.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, well, it seems to me that Thompson, you know, Thompson's strength might be that he's not Giuliani, and that might be important for sort of framing the nomination campaign. I mean, who is going to be the alternative? It could be Romney. Romney certainly got the organization in Iowa, but is he going to be able to carry that through to February 5th? He spent a lot of money, certainly in very, you know, specific areas, but not across the board. I mean, it's hard to unravel that. And I think Thompson's attractiveness is sort of that he's not one of these other people. And whether when we find out, you know, how he feels about abortion, and it's not quite constitutional amendment territory, and he's more of a states writer, you know, how is the religious right going to respond to that? Is that going to be attractive quality? That certainly has a Reagan-esque notion to it, but, you know, it's not quite the policy that is currently the one most Republicans desire.
There is a continuing conflict between President Bush and Congress over the S-CHIP program. And the Senate recently passed on a 64-30 vote the $35 billion version to expand the state children's health insurance program, and it hasn't gone anywhere in the House. probably because they don't have a two-thirds majority to be able to override the expected presidential veto. Do you expect that Congress and President Bush are actually going to get together and come up with something that everybody can agree to, or is this just going to become another issue in the upcoming congressional elections and possibly the presidential election as well?
I think both sides would love to see it come up as an issue in the presidential election, which it would be more likely to do if it's not resolved. I think that the Democrats would certainly hope to have an issue like this to summarize their feelings about President Bush's domestic policy stance and then, by implication, the Republican Party's domestic policy stance. And I think that President Bush is just looking around pretty actively right now for things to veto, so that he can claim that the Democratic-dominated Congress is being spending happy, is not being responsible with people's money. And as a result, this claim that would appear to be resting on a bit of a shaky foundation that has to do with how, if the S-CHIP bill were to come into effect, then people would qualify for this children's health insurance program in the state of New York if they earned up to $83,000, which, as far as I can understand, is not actually the case, is a powerful motivator, I think, the administration feels, for Republican primary voters who are upset with the idea of a possible Democratic president and Democratic-led Congress spending them into oblivion and raising their taxes.
I think this is an important issue also in the congressional races. This is something that in swing districts could really matter. It's a very popular bill. It's one where you're going to, people have real votes. Incumbents are going to have to defend that vote either against the president or not. Here in New Mexico, we have in Congressional District 1, which incorporates Albuquerque, we have Congresswoman Heather Wilson, and she's actually running for the Senate seat that Pete Domenici is leaving, along with 2nd Congressional District Steve Paris. Pierce, he voted to uphold the veto, and she voted to overturn it. I think that's an interesting dynamic, both for the nomination campaign in the Republican Party and eventually then for the general election campaign.
Well, that brings up a good question. I mean, President Bush is clearly a lame duck president. Is it a surprise, as in terms of how much support he's able to hold on to in his own party in the Senate, particularly on a bill like this, where, it's pretty easy to portray someone who votes against it as being against children's health and things like that, although it's a more complex issue by far. But is it surprising that that the Republicans in Congress have maintained party discipline and have supported the president?
Probably not. I think one of the most striking things about contemporary politics is that over time, the level of polarization between the two parties has varied. There have been times when there have been a lot of overlaps between the two parties, where they're both sitting to a greater extent in the middle than they have been in the past. This is the opposite of those times. The two parties are moving apart in both the Congress and in the nation as a whole in their attitudes toward a number of major issues. And so the result is that our typical expectation that anybody who wants to get elected or to stay elected or to maintain his popularity into the future, into history, would want to hit middle-of-the-road positions is no longer accurate. President Bush understands that he has a Republican Party that is considerably more conservative than the Republican Party was in the 70s and the 60s, and that in order to maintain the loyalty of those Republicans, and certainly the people who give money within that branch of the electorate, because of the fact that people who give money often tend to be more on the extreme of their party, that he should not be moving to the middle, that he should be moving to the right. And Democratic candidates in mirror image understand that their biggest support is pretty clearly on the left right now.
I think there's a lot of issues coming up, and I think they might expand over the next several months. We had this water bill. I think that one's going to be important to look at, because that did not have veto-safe overrides. That was extremely popular in both the Senate and the House. I think only 12 members of the Senate voted against it. So it seems to me that there's the possibility you know, there's this first bill, there's a possibility of having an overturn on the presidential veto, even within his own party. I mean, he's going to have to twist arms to make those people decide, no, we're not going to do the you know, overriding the veto on all of these water bills, which are going to help a lot of different people, including probably some industries and state and some localities. So I think that, you know, we might have our first veto override possibility here, and how that plays out in the next several months could be important to sort of the president's future as a policy leader domestically.
Yeah, the vote on that bill was 81-12 in the Senate and 381-40 in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, you get the impression that people really want those water projects,
which is
perfectly understandable.
Well, the water bill, I mean, when it comes up, has traditionally been a place where members of Congress bring home the bacon, as it were. Those projects are generally fairly visible. They are touted as helping industry or the environment or something, wherever they happen to be done. And I don't want to go into the merits of each individual project contained in the bill, but I think it's safe to say there's probably some pork in there somewhere.
Pretty high-stakes stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's worthwhile to look through recent American history about water rights and what that means. We take a look now at the southeast of the United States and the extent to which Georgia is complaining that the Army Corps of Engineers is letting Florida and Alabama divert some of Georgia's water supply, which Georgia has certainly done a good job of over the last few years in voting down creating new reservoirs. Water is crucial in American life, and there are some parts of it that have a whole lot less than they need, especially in the western part of the United States. And those folks are understandably going to fight very hard to get their share of what we all know from second grade is the limited amount of water on Earth. This is a zero-sum game. What somebody gains, somebody else loses.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Carl in Madison. Carl,
howdy.
Good morning.
Howdy. I lived out in New York for a few years and moved back to Wisconsin long before 9/11. But I'm still in contact with friends I made out in New York and even two Republicans, New York City I'm talking about. Most of the friends would be progressive. But my question is, and I don't know what kind of response I want from you, but I'd like to know whether this has any legs. Universally, or I don't know anybody that I know at New York that give Rudy Giuliani any credibility whatsoever. They've pointed out to me the scandal involving the Motorola radios for the firemen and the fact that he located the 911 center in the Twin Towers when he was cautioned against doing that. And I mean, they really don't like him, and yet he makes his reputation off of this. Does this story have any legs when people come to understand this? Do you think this is going to backfire him or what?
I think there's that real possibility. I don't think he has been scrutinized very well at a national level with regard to his activities as mayor, including all those surrounding 9/11. It's certainly to come up during a general election. I don't think he's been tested on that ground. He's pretty much just gotten the nod that he was mayor of the city. He did a great job. There was a great response. But there certainly are those sayings within New York City itself. And I think that is a potential, a potential problem for him coming down the road.
Thank you.
I would assume that whoever wins the Democratic nomination, that we're going to be seeing an ad campaign that has a series of faces and voices from New York City, particularly from among the Republican population, saying that Giuliani isn't what he was cracked up to be. Lana talked earlier about the question of authenticity. I think that it's certainly accurate that many voters look for somebody who is true to him or herself for whatever reason, and the possibility that Giuliani is touting a reputation that he doesn't in fact have in New York is bound to be central to the campaign. But I think it's also worth, and I think Carl brought this up himself, keeping in mind that in a polarized time, we do tend to talk to people who often share our views, and it's not surprising as a result to find that the people we talk to pretty much reinforce what it is that we believed about Giuliani or about anybody else. So, although I think that ad would certainly be coming because it would easily be sensible for the Democratic nominee to find and easy to find people in New York who can make the claim that Giuliani is not what he was cracked up to be, that not all New Yorkers feel that way.
Let's take a call from Ron in Superior this time. Ron, good morning.
Hi. You know, I this is fascinating listening to the discussion, and I really hate in a sense to go back a bit, but a while back you were talking about the issue of electability, and you know, back about 3 weeks ago now, there was this summit period in which evangelical right meetings took place, three different groups and one weekend in October discussing who they look for their candidate. And this led to an awful lot of speculation on the internet as to what might happen, what might follow. And one column I read found an interesting speculation. If Giuliani was a GOP candidate and Clinton's a Democratic candidate, and from your conversation, it seems that you people kind of think that's probable. They speculated on a split in which evangelical right groups found their own candidate and ran a third-party candidacy, probably expecting to lose, but to demonstrate to the Republicans how much they need that evangelical vote. And they came up with a wild speculation of Clinton getting 373 electoral college votes and Giuliani bottoming out at no more than 48 electoral college votes, with the balance going to an evangelical candidacy. And that, by the way, would have another interesting effect, and that was to split the traditional solid Republican South. Does that seem at all interesting as a speculation to any of you people? Because I don't think that major issues like foreign policy and what's happening in Pakistan is going to move this election. I think it's going to be a traditional American election in a very untraditional time. And issues that are very narrow, perhaps, and very specialized for certain interest groups will rule.
Well, Ross Perot didn't get a single electoral college vote. He almost got one in Maine, but he didn't. So I think it's unlikely that a third-party candidate would do well in the electoral college. That means they would have to win a plurality of support in some particular state.
Well, if in fact, any evangelical candidate could carry Texas and Florida, it's going to have an impact. You can't ignore that. And
I certainly wouldn't ignore it, but it certainly would be a huge surprise. It's hard to imagine that they could actually carry in the face of, you know, basically a split Republican Party, that they would end up carrying a particular state like that, either Texas or Florida. It seems to me that that would, especially Florida, that seems it would be likely to go Democratic then. You know, I think if the Republicans were to do that, they would, you know, certainly guarantee a Democratic election, which is what you were saying. But I don't, you know, it's hard to imagine. I mean, Ross Perot had a lot of money, a lot of resources, and he did very well as a third-party candidate, traditionally speaking. And yet,
these speculations
no,
at least suggest a lot of old verities being shattered in this election, that this is going to be a crucial election in a lot of ways, and none of us know how it will come out.
Yeah, I wouldn't be putting my horses, you know, any money on a third party getting electoral college votes. But that's just, you know, I'm basing that on history.
Yeah, you know, the last, we've seen some electoral college votes to a third party candidate with our old friend Strom Thurmond, who finally died in the Senate when he was about 304 years old. He got electoral votes from South Carolina when he ran as a Dixiecrat candidate for president in 1948. You have to have strength in particular areas, and I think what Ron is suggesting is that perhaps this will be the case with the Christian right. But if, in all of those areas where the Christian right is particularly strong in very various southern states, there's also a substantial African-American vote, which will most likely go Democratic. I think a lot of Republicans had sort of hoped that they could appeal to both African-American and Latino-American voters with socially conservative stands on same-sex marriage and on other issues, but this is going to be a very hard sell, and I think that there are an awful lot of Christian evangelicals who, in the end, are going to ask themselves, what's most fearsome to me, to have a Republican Party that is moving away from evangelical issues or to have a Democratic Party that's winning?
Thank you.
Ron, thanks for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more discussion about politics. Always a fascinating topic here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9:53 on this Monday morning, the 5th of November. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. And after 10 o'clock this morning, this year marks the 35th anniversary of the passage of Title IX, the first comprehensive federal law prohibiting sex discrimination against students and employees of educational institutions. And in the next hour, we'll be talking about the history of the law and how far we've come in 35 years. That's after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about all things political and, of course, the biggest political news on the block these days is the presidential race. So we've been continuing to talk about that. That's kind of occupied most of our hour. And maybe we can find something else to talk about for just a few minutes. But, gosh, it just seems like that's about the only thing that's going on out there that people want to pay attention to. Well, what about the Mukasey nomination? How that appeared to be in trouble, and now it looks like a couple of key Democrats have decided to support Mukasey as the attorney general. But last week there was a pretty big dust up over the waterboarding topic. How big a deal is this?
Well, it's only a big deal if it interferes with Mr. Mukasey's getting confirmed, although I'm sure that it's going to continue to be an issue in the campaign. I think that this is another of those polarizing issues that fit in so well with the division between the two parties that we see right now. On the one hand, there are people who are shocked at the thought that the administration would condone something like that. There are a lot of other people who say we've got a lot of enemies out there, just as we were talking about earlier, the view that if people can remain scared, they'll continue to vote for people who appear to be especially strong internationally, and that as a result, whatever it is that we do, it's okay, because they do it anyway, and we have to do at least as much as anybody else in order to try to win this global war on terror. So I think both parties are playing to their base here, and I think they're doing a very good job of it.
Yeah.
I agree. Go ahead.
No, I agree.
Okay, let's go to another issue. Ralph Nader is suing the Democratic Party over some things that happened in the last election. Yeah, I hear that. And I don't want to make light of Mr. Nader because he's occupied a rather important place in politics over the years. But how relevant is Ralph Nader these days?
Not very. Probably the best answer I could come up with. I think it's very interesting because 40 years ago, Ralph Nader was a striking voice in American politics. He graduated from Princeton, came to work in Washington, ended up actually being a major force in politics thanks to General Motors, because when he started investigating the Chevy Corvair, General Motors, I guess, hired a private investigation firm to follow him around, figuring that he was too clean to be possible, you know, and that if they could get some sort of scandalous information on him, that would discredit him.
And he won an invasion of privacy suit against General Motors for enough $1 million to set up the public interest research group. So I guess we have both General Motors and Ralph Nader to thank for what he's done since that time. But he's really taken a turn that a lot of people who would have certainly supported his activities a number of years ago are having a little more trouble with now. There are some people who believe very sincerely that a third party and perhaps many third parties are absolutely crucial in American politics, and that a multi-party system is only reasonable in a society that's this varied and this big. But there are others who make the counter-argument who say what we need is people to be able to simplify the choices that they're making, because most of us are not watching politics and don't want to watch politics and want to be able to say yes or no to a series of two choices, so that in the end we can hold the government that ends up getting elected responsible for what it does. I'm not sure that the latter view is all that prevalent in American society, but I think it ends up because of all of the tremendous barriers to a third party being the one that Nader is confronted with.
Well, we're out of time. We're confronted by the clock.
All right.
Well, it's inevitable. Thank you both for spending this hour with our listeners.
You're
most welcome.
Margie Hershey is professor of political science at Indiana University. Alana Atkison is professor of political science at the University of New Mexico. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. And John Treader handled on-air production this morning. If you'd like a copy of the program, call the radio store at 747-7444 and ask for program 115D, as in dog. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.